If it's happening now, we're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Major Tom McKay is on the board while Will Erskine booking the guests in the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
It is Hamilton Today. I'm Scott Thompson, 900 CHML. Lots to talk about, and especially local. And here we go again. What more continuation of the superpowers of a mayor to be used or not to be used? Listen.
The adventures of Supermayor. Faster than a speeding bullet. More powerful than a locomotive. Able to leap tall buildings at a single bound.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird.
It's a plane.
It's Supermayor. Yes, it's Supermayor, strange visitor from another planet who came to Earth with powers and abilities far beyond those of mortal mayors. Supermayor.
Who can change the course of mighty rivers, bend steel in his bare hands.
So, disguised as Andrea Horvath, mild mannered mayor for the great hammer, the city of Hamilton, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the Hamilton way.
Yeah! 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 There you go. You know, when Major Tom works so hard to produce a piece like this, you got to get the mileage out of it. That's the way I look at it. And this on the story that you heard earlier on today, that the mayor, of course, using superpowers, the Paul part of the story with the it's the parking lot versus housing. Stony Creek, film at 11, CH. You know, it's that thing. So the debate to me is a good one, and everybody should be having it. I believe the word compromise is probably going to lead to success here, but I digress. I don't want to weigh too much into city politics. You know me, I'm just not like that. But what I do find really funny in all of this is that, and you know, I'm not going to debate whether the superpowers are good or bad, or whether you should use them or shouldn't use them, or the debate here and the housing, what have you. But I think what is most humorous, which is ironic, pick the word you want to use, that, you know, a couple of the people, the mayors, who spoke out so strongly against this and, like, just, you know, crapped all over the government, the provincial government, particularly the premier, for even how dare you even come up with this undemocratic tool and blah, 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 blah. And the people that barked the most are now using it. And, you know, even the mayor of Burlington said on this show, well, I didn't ask for it. Well, that doesn't mean you have to use it. The premier gave you the option. The option. It was the individual mayors that decided to reach into the toolbox with their bare hands and pull out that tool. And I'm not here to debate that. But I think it's hilarious that those that didn't even want to look at the toolbox are now fishing around inside for the tools and saying, well, it's different here because it's from my point of view instead of the opposition's or the other person's or whoever's. So again, you know, democracy, go nuts, you know, and let's debate all of this. Let's have it out. But let's do it honestly and call it for what it is. And it just seems interesting to me that the people who complain the most about this appear to be using it the most. But I digress. All right. We got another jam-packed show. Hope you hang around for it. The Prime Minister continuing to try to sell the budget. And as we watch this once great left of center party go to the extreme left, I mean, it's just, man, this is what socialism feels like. This is an NDP world that we're living in. Tax everybody, you know, everybody in the middle class gets hit, whether it's a carbon tax, whether it's your family cottage, whether it's a doctor trying to open a practice to service you. It's just unbelievable. And, you know, the Prime Minister knows that everybody's angry. He just doesn't seem to realize that everybody's angry with him. And as I've said before, we don't need another Walmart greeter. We need someone who knows how to manage the store. And for the man that thinks he's saving the planet, it's amazing that he can't do just that. And when he fails to do that and we become unproductive, there's no investment, there's no ingenuity, there's no productivity. His solution is to tax over and over and over again. And he said of Pierre Poilievre in the last news cycle, Pierre Poilievre will do anything to win. He is winning. That's the problem. You know, he's like Donald Trump spinning it around. The prime minister is trying anything to win. And it's amazing, as half of Canadians have a negative, more than half have a negative issue of the budget. And of course, the stats yesterday, you know, it's more of the same. Nothing has really changed here. So it's fascinating to see as we move forward and where this all goes. We got a jam-packed show. Really make your head smoke today. Lots to think about. Tasha Carradine is going to be joining us and talk about the protest marches going on in regard to the Hamas-Israeli conflict across the country. TikTok, it looks like the U.S. is moving through with its ban, which to me isn't any different than us banning Huawei from 5G, which everybody did, except, of course, the prime minister. We'll talk about that. And, oh, the Lancaster is in the news. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Also, get a head up into space with Paul Delaney. So lots to do up in the sky when there's less sunshine down here. Tasha Carradine has an interesting piece in the National Post, anti-Israel hate marches holding the rest of us hostage while Trudeau shrugs. The latest round of anti-Israel protests has crossed the line. Canada, this is the first paragraph, Canada used to be a nation of peace, order, and good government. Not anymore. You'd be hard-pressed to find any of the three on the streets of Ottawa last weekend at a Palestinian protest which glorified Hamas and its violent assault on October 7th. To talk about all of this, Tasha Carradine, journalist, writer with the National Post, G-Zero Media, and her Substack page, In My Opinion, author of The Right Path. Tasha, thanks for the time. Hope you're doing well.
Yes, thanks so much, Brett.
I remember, and I have since the beginning of this, and perhaps because I don't have quite the depth that you or some of your colleagues do, but I've asked over and over and over again whenever I have academics on, how do Palestinians separate themselves from Hamas? And nobody seems to be able to answer that question or is very, very vague in the answer. What part of this discussion are Canadians missing?
Well, I don't really have an answer for that question either. I mean, obviously not all Palestinians support Hamas, but Hamas has been reelected as the government in Gaza multiple times. So clearly, majority do, at least in Gaza. In the rest of the world, the diaspora, I don't know. And in Canada, I think the frustration is that this issue has become, people have been using this issue in the public space to take over the public space for their cause. It is not a cause, per se, that affects Canada directly. Canada is not at war. Canada is not there on the ground. You know, it is to constantly take over streets. And on top of it, it's not simply occupying space, but hateful rhetoric targeting another group within Canadian society, which is Jews, with vandalism, with threats, with, you know, broken windows, like you name it. I mean, my Jewish friends do not feel safe. It is ridiculous. This is what Canadians, I think, are just looking at. How is this happening? And how are we letting this happen? Because no group, no matter what their cause, no group should be able to do this here. You know, if you want to express those sentiments, there are places you can do that. In fact, it's in Gaza, essentially. And I think to tell Hamas, you know, to stand down, because until Hamas stands down, releases the hostages, and stops its hateful behavior towards Israel and its attacks, there's going to be no end to this. So, you know, that's where the conversation has to go. It's not going to happen here. And people are getting fed up, quite frankly, with what they're seeing as a hijacking of the agenda at all levels, government, academia, our public space, everything. It is incredibly frustrating. People are just fed up.
So is the view of this changing from when this first started to today? Are Canadians viewing this differently now?
Well, I don't know if there's polling on this. I'd be very interested to see if there has been polling done on Canadians' attitudes writ large and also within different communities. Because what you are seeing, obviously, is this is an issue more with people who do have a relationship to the region, whether it is ethnicity, family, origin, whatnot. You know, the Milton by-election provincially has become dominated by the issue of Gaza. That is, to me, a very upsetting thing. I understand people have strong feelings about this, but at the same time, this is not, like I said, this is not Canada's fight or issue. We as a country take a position, yes, but to constantly, you know, make this the number one cause is disingenuous when there are so many problems domestically that we our governments are supposed to be focused on. And it's a monopolizing because there is a demographic shift that's happened in parts of the GTA in particular, like Milton, where you do have a majority Muslim population. And so consequently, you know, candidates feel they have to make this an issue so that they win. And this is this explains the vote on the kafia in the legislature, which is absurd. No political symbol, no matter what it is, should be allowed in the legislature. It is not. I don't care if it's a kafia. I don't care if it is, you know, a hammer and sickle for the, you know, for the Russian. Like, you just don't. You're not supposed to. So our politics is being twisted by this issue. And that, again, also is very frustrating to people saying, you know, again, enough.
And again, are these the issues on the kitchen table for the majority of Canadians? Is this they is this what they want their government leaders to be doing at this time?
No, and it's not. And it's also the way it's being done. You know, the march in Ottawa this weekend was really symptomatic of that. You had people yelling outright hatred filled slogans and statements in support of Hamas, saying, you know, our resistance attacks are proof we are almost free. Well, we know what that was referring to. It was referring to the rape, murder, and torture and kidnapping of 1,200 men, women, and children in Israel on the 7th of October. How does that make you free? It doesn't, because as I say, any regime that would do that is not going to make you free. If they run your country, they will be despots and tyrants, and they'll do the same to you if they don't like you. So it is completely disingenuous. And it also, it strikes terror in the hearts of Jews around the country. I mean, it really does. I think if you did a poll among Jewish Canadians, they would tell you that this situation has made them feel more threatened than they have ever since the Holocaust happened. So, you know, again, it's the way this is being done. It's fine to make political statements. It's fine to do it in a respectful way that we do it here in Canada. We don't do this. And I think that message has to be telegraphed to people saying, you know what, no matter whether you're from Canada, when you're born here, where you're born somewhere else, we don't care. We don't do that. I didn't support the protests in Ottawa, the occupation of Ottawa by the convoy either, but it didn't rise to this level. This takes it one notch above because it's targeting another group in society deliberately with hatred. But, you know, we have to return to a baseline of civility in this country in terms of how we handle debates and differences of opinion and trying to encourage governments to do things. This is not how it's done. We don't bully people. This is bullying, and it should stop.
Tasha Kieradin with us. Her latest in the Post, anti-Israel hate marches holding the rest of us hostage while Trudeau shrugs. The latest round of anti-Israel protest has crossed a major line. Tasha, as always, thanks so much for the time. Be well.
Thank you. You too.
We talked about this a while ago, and many people, including my kids, thought that we'd never see this day, or at least us moving closer towards what might be the day. But yesterday there was a bill that went through, or I guess it completed today, where in amongst money for Ukraine and so on and so forth, and in Israel, was a ban on TikTok if they did not sell, and that being the owners, which are like every business in China, controlled by the Chinese Communist Party, unless they sell that stake. And lo and behold, it looks like this is going to pass. Or is it? What does this mean? David Shipley with the cybersecurity expert, CEO of Boceron Security, with us now. David, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am. Thank you.
So I remember talking about this, David, several weeks ago, months ago, what have you. Are you surprised we are where we are right now?
No, not at all. This ideologically makes 100% sense for the United States. It's crazy that it's taken this long. It's one of those few times that you actually see complete bipartisan alignment. It is nuts to have a company with this massive influence in American culture, particularly in younger generations, as for many, their primary source of news and entertainment, controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. It's just unfathomable. And particularly in this new Cold War, this is what we can expect more of as things balkanize. So it has passed the House, it's passed the Senate, President Biden has put his signature on it, and the clock is on. So if ByteDance wants to exit and make some money, they better do it. If the Chinese government decides to draw an ideological line in the sand and prevent the sale, then I don't think the Americans are going to blink, which then raises an interesting question. Are we going to do this here in Canada? We don't typically have a government that pays attention to national security, and that goes across both of the major parties. But we're going to have to if the Americans do it.
Is this any different than the debate over Huawei and whether they should be a part of the backbone of the 5G network?
Absolutely, is part of the same thing. You're talking about the difference between having the ability to potentially cause technological havoc by embedding vulnerabilities and spying or failure points in critical infrastructure on the Huawei side. On TikTok, you are talking about access to a different kind of national resource, which is the collective consciousness and attention span of Americans. Now, some people are saying that this kind of regulation of people's attention and information is, you know, is beyond the pale. Well, hey, man, we've done it for radio and television since their inception.
Yeah.
It's just that we use the ephemeral radio spectrum as the reason for regulation back in the day. But the reality is human attention span is also a national resource. And are we going to let folks who are openly hostile to Western liberal democratic values game the system? Because if we do, we're in trouble.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here, David, and give you the obvious question, and you tell me the way we should be digesting this. If you're TikTok, we don't do that, and there's no proof of that. We're separate.
I don't believe you.
Yeah.
and listen, there's some real disturbing trends. The rise in anti-Semitism in youth and just the absolute skyrocketing of this, and the preponderance of conflict videos and disinformation and misinformation and manipulation in TikTok right now is beyond the pale. So even if it wasn't directly told by the Chinese Communist Party, they're certainly telling them not to turn it down. I mean, this is a government that tightly controls the news in their own country. And by the way, they strictly regulate TikTok in their own borders because they know how dangerous it is. So don't tell me they don't know how to play us like a fiddle. So, you know, is that saying that just because they transfer it over to Meta, does that become TikTok become unicorns and rainbows and good for society? No, I mean, all social media still is the big tobacco for the 22nd or 21st century. But it means that the people who are ideologically opposed to concepts like democracy or capitalism aren't pulling the strings behind the scenes.
So what about a buyer? Is this logical to think that that China's going to let this company go? I mean, what happens here?
Well, I mean, we're talking a lot of money at stake, right? So do they really double down and not blink at the Americans and burn this resource, which in the end of the day benefits Meta and others, because instead of having to buy TikTok and pay cash, they just build the American version of TikTok from the ground up and go after those customers. So the Americans win either way. The question for China is, like, do we stand on principle on this and try and maintain whatever presence we can in other countries like Canada and other places who may demand a different ownership structure? I don't know. We're in brand new ground. I think anyone that claims they know exactly how this story is going to play out, no way. I mean, if you had told me 10 years ago the Chinese Communist Party would control the most popular media platform for youth in the world, I'd say, you're crazy. And here we are.
Are you surprised at the resistance to this, David, even by the youth? Like, even my kids, like, what's going on, Dad? How come this is happening? Why don't they worry about other things? Are you surprised at some of the reaction here?
Nah, man, you ever see a smoker quit?
Yeah.
stuff's addictive, right? Like, and you get real moody about this, and people are really emotionally invested. And that's my point of how powerfully and damn dangerous this thing is. You know, the way that this affects the brain's neurochemistry, how it releases dopamine, how the algorithms can be used to, like, literally keep people eyeballs in and change their perceptions. I mean, in one hand, I realize I'm sounding like a bad 1950s script for the Manchurian Candidate, but the other thing, I'm pointing at real known neuroscience facts. So, yeah.
Is the race on now to build the better mousetrap? Because I said that to my kids. Like, do you honestly think someone else can't do this better in like 6 months? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, no, there's nothing massively unique. What TikTok proved is that short content is massively popular and algorithms can drive massive amount of eyeballs. You can bet your bottom dollar Meta is pouring into this. The advantage TikTok has is the advantage that any social media has once it has incumbency and scale. And that's what we call the network effect. And that's a really hard competitive advantage to overcome because people hate switching. Like once you get used to, once you all your friends are there, you know, it's a cool place to hang out. No one wants to go to the Meta loser club. There's like 10 people there.
Yeah.
But if the other one gets shut down because the cops raided it, well, the new club starts up and eventually people start dancing over there.
So what happens over the next 9 months, David?
we see the battle between unstoppable force and an immovable object. They get real interesting. And you can bet there might be other Chinese retaliation in economic form or other form against the United States for doing this. This is a bold move by the Americans, and I'll be honest, it's refreshing that for once across both sides of the entire political spectrum in the United States, from crazy to sane, from Democrat to Republican, everyone's kind of like, oh, we got to deal with this. So I'm going to take a breath of fresh air, and then we're going to plunge back into probably all watching an insane court trial in New York.
You know, so there's at least two good things out of this. So other jurisdictions going to follow here, David? We've got seconds left.
I don't know. The Americans of all Western civilization are currently the most keen on national defense, and we've kind of outsourced all things global security to them. Canada, I mean, we can't even have a sane conversation about Chinese interference in our actual nomination process for candidates. Yeah. So I don't think TikTok's going to make the agenda here.
David Chipley with us, cybersecurity expert, CEO of Boceron Security, the U.S. moving to ban TikTok unless it changes ownership. David, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
You too. Take care.
We certainly know the history of the Lancaster and what it means to this city and bringing it literally back to life. And now the Lancaster prepares for a trip back home to Goderich. How does that fit into all of this story and painting another, really creating another chapter in this storied aircraft? Al Mikuloff with his marketing manager of the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum with us now. Al, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Yes, I am. Thank you, Scott.
So you're going to have to go, obviously, back to the beginning and the history of this plane to tell us how Goderich fits in to the history and this other chapter that you're creating, which, you know, again, every time I read these little things, I get goosebumps. It's pretty cool. So tell everybody the history and how Goderich is involved in what you're doing.
Sure, absolutely. You know, our Lancaster is certainly well-known in Hamilton now. We're entering our 36th year of flying the Lancaster, which is hard for us to actually believe. But back in 1964, the Royal Canadian Air Force were retiring their Lancasters, and the president of the Legion up in Goderich, Bill Clancy, thought it would be a great idea to acquire a Lancaster as a war memorial. So he went about doing that, and he obtained it. And on June 14th, 1964. The Lancaster was flown to Goderich, and eventually they had it mounted on a pedestal. Now, Bill Clancy had the foresight to have the Lancaster mounted on its jacking points, which would ensure that there was minimal structural damage and a little stress on the aircraft should someone decide to fly the aircraft in the future. So he had some great foresight and was probably responsible for the Lancaster being able to be restored to flying condition again. Most of the ones that get put on pedestals are so damaged they can't be flown again.
Right.
So it remained up in Goderich from 1964 till about 1977 when the Legion had a hard time maintaining it. So there was deterioration, there was vandalism, and it became a huge bird's nest. It was just full of birds that lived in it. And it was becoming almost beyond their financial means. At about that time, two of our members just happened to come along and thought, well, it'd be great to add a Lancaster to our collection. You know, Canadian Warplane Heritage were only operating a couple of years at that point, so they thought that would be a great addition. So they went about, and eventually the aircraft was offered from the Legion for about $10,000 to Canadian Warplane Heritage. Now, back then, the museum didn't have any funds, so they couldn't acquire it. Thanks to the Sully Foundation, they provided the funding, and the aircraft was acquired by Canadian Warplane Heritage. So, like I said, June 14th, 1964 is when it arrived in Goderich. A lot of people showed up there. So 60 years to the day, we are going back, and we expect a lot of people to be on the ground to see the Lancaster, and we'd like to show it off to the Goderich folks again.
What amazes me, and every time I hear another story about the, not only the Lancaster, but this particular one, it just continues on. I mean, many would have thought when it was rolled into Goderich that that would have been it. And here you are, however many years later, taking the flying plane back. That is incredible when you think about it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it gets better than that. 10 years ago, we flew this Lancaster over to England, where it flew with the other flying Lancaster.
Yeah.
14 years ago was the last time we went, we took the Lancaster on the road in Canada. In fact, we're just putting the final details on our first tour in that time. We were heading out to Western Canada. We're still working out the details, but we should let you know in a few weeks where we're headed.
So that's, again, another great chapter to add to all of this. So why does this keep drawing so much attention? Obviously, the history keeps evolving, but, you know, even in Goderich, how do you explain that?
You know, sometimes it's actually difficult. I think it's, at the end of the day, it's still it's a fitting tribute to an extraordinary generation, you know, who set the standard for duty and sacrifice for our future generations. I'd like to think that's what it is.
And so what's on the agenda for when you're up in Goderich? How will it be received there?
Sure. So we arrive on the Friday, June 14th in the morning, probably around 10 o'clock. I'm sure we'll do a few fly past, and then we're going to land. There's going to be some opening ceremonies, and then we're going to open up the aircraft for inside tours. And there's going to be a barbecue available from the local Copa group. And then there'll be some entertainment in the evening. The next day, we're going to do a local flight for some very special people. And about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we will head back to Hamilton because we want to be back in time for Father's Day here.
Wow. Well, of course. Absolutely. A busy agenda for this plane. What an exciting chapter, an exciting thing to do. And of course, be a part of. Al Mikloff with us, marketing manager with the Canadian Warplane Heritage Museum. Good luck with all of this, Al.
Thank you.
If Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer,
he'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk,
900 CHML.
Maybe here's a good idea, a good reason to hang on to some of your old technology, whether it's your Pong game or your VCR. NASA has heard from the Voyager 1. It's the most distant spacecraft from Earth after, and not necessarily radio silence, but certainly some garbled communication. To talk about this older spacecraft, let's bring in Paul Delaney, Professor Emeritus, Faculty of Science, Department of Physics, Astronomy, York University, here now. Paul, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
I am indeed, Scott. Always nice to chat with you.
This I find fascinating, as I always do when we talk. To give us some history of the Voyager 1. This is like late 1970s tech here.
It's actually early 1970s tech. Voyager was launched in 1977. So the computer hardware on board was probably circa 74, 5 or thereabouts. So we're talking about 50-year-old technology. We're talking about an operating system that most modern computer scientists would go, really? and the amount of memory that's on board, your phone kills it hands down. So yes, this is really old technology, but the spacecraft is still operating. And other than one little chip that had a little bit of corrupted memory, it's working great. And now they've figured out how to rewrite the software to get around that corrupted piece of memory. That's all it was, one chip and corrupted memory, and it basically took Voyager out of communication with us for the last 4 or 5 months.
It is fascinating that they figured this out, that they figured out a way to basically go around the problem and make this piece functional again.
For all of the high school students out there who are aspiring engineers, this is a great story. The things that you can do as an engineer this spacecraft is, give or take a bit, 25 billion kilometers away. A signal takes 22.5 hours one way to reach it. And as we said earlier, the technology is 50 years old. Yet, Mission Control, with all of their team, were able to figure out what the problem was, devise a fix, and that fix was uploaded last week. And as of, I think it was April 20th, has been transmitting. Voyager has been transmitting comprehensible data once again.
There you go. Not just a bunch of people out there goofing around, that's for sure. So how long was this supposed to last, the life of this craft?
The best before date was approximately 5 years. So if they got to both Jupiter and Saturn with successful rendezvous, which they did, then they declared the mission a success. But Voyager 1 was, after it went past Titan, a moon around Saturn, it was targeted for the exit door. Unlike Voyager 2, its companion spacecraft, which went on to visit Uranus and Neptune very successfully, Voyager 1 was targeted at Jupiter, Saturn, and Titan. And in the process of visiting Titan, it precluded the opportunity to go into the outer solar system where planets were. So instead, it was heading off to what we call the heliopause, that junction between where the sun controls the environment around the solar system and interstellar space. And Voyager crossed that boundary, the heliopause, in 2012. So it's been traveling in what we term interstellar space for 11 years. But the answer to your question was 5 years.
So what can we still learn from this?
Well, we've got two spacecraft that are operating, Voyager 1 and Voyager 2, in a region that we just cannot simulate here on Earth. We don't really know what the environment is beyond the solar system. We've got theories, but these two spacecraft are actually living the dream. They are venturing into interstellar space, telling us the composition, the cosmic ray density, the magnetic field composition, the literal environment that exists between the stars. And while that might sound terribly boring, it's really quite essential for us to better understand the way the galaxy as a whole evolves. It's a region which we just cannot detect directly from Earth. We see stars, we see galaxies, but we actually can't sort of stick a probe in the interstellar medium. We've got to put a probe in the interstellar medium, and that's what the Voyagers are doing. So it's absolutely invaluable data about the composition between the stars.
So are we physically making the craft do more than it was actually capable of doing in the late 70s? I mean, it's going farther, it's lasting longer, all of that, but can we actually change what it does? Can we grow the craft as technology grows?
Not really.
Or is it limited?
We're static. The equipment that is on board was used to monitor Jupiter, Saturn, Titan. It's the same equipment, more or less, that is being used to sample the interstellar medium. Now, obviously, the cameras are off. We decommissioned the cameras decades ago because there's nothing to see out there. And the camera technology is 1970s technology anyway. So there have been some of the instruments that have been powered down to preserve the onboard power source. It's basically a radioisotope which is decaying away, giving us energy, and that energy is steadily running out. By about 2030, there will not even be enough energy on board to transmit, to use the computers and to transmit the data. So we have been paring down the onboard operations to the bare minimum to make sure that we could still, as I said, probe for the cosmic rays, probe for the magnetic fields. So those instruments which we use at Jupiter and Saturn successfully and can be still used in the interstellar medium, those are the only ones that are operating on board. But it's the same set of equipment that we used in the 70s.
And it should last till the end of the decade. Is that accurate?
That's correct. Assuming nothing else happens. I mean, you know, 50 years nearly, you know, degrading memory. Anything could happen to it. But at the moment, it is purring like an old car.
That is a great story. Paul Delaney with us, Professor Emeritus, Faculty of Science, Department of Physics and Astronomy, York University. Kids, jump on board. Voyager 1 still going strong. Paul, thanks for the time. Be well.
Take care, Scott.
Don't go away. We're coming right back.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
You know, it's fascinating that years after the global pandemic, COVID-19, we certainly remember how it literally brought the world to a stop and changed things forever in our lives. And I remember at the beginning of all of this, talking to various epidemiologists and such, trying to figure out what was going on and what it was all about. And I remember talking to a lady who was a bright young lady talking about SARS and how they literally found right down to the first person that developed the virus. And I remember saying to her, that's amazing that you could find out exactly where this came from, the origins. And her response was, ain't science great, which I just thought was hilarious. And the question has been since COVID-19, why haven't we been able to do the same with this virus? Let's bring in Charles Burton, senior fellow with Synopsis End here now. Charles, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I am, Scott. Beautiful sunny day here in Ottawa.
So your thoughts, Charles, why have we not been able to get to the origins of this when we have found out others such as SARS? You know, it's sort of the same type of virus. What's different here?
Well, I think the difference is that the Chinese government screwed up the announcement of person-to-person transmission at the local level. And so they don't want to be taking the blame for unnecessary millions of deaths across the globe from this virus because they didn't take appropriate action early on. And we've had a consistent pattern of Chinese government obfuscation and blocking of the international scientific community to get to the bottom of it, not to speak of ridiculous deflections like saying, well, it really originated in Fort Detrick in Maryland, who created the virus on purpose and then brought it to the military games in Wuhan in November 2019, and that's where it started, or it came from Italy. But the bottom line is that, you know, there are two areas that we have concerns about. One is the Wuhan Institute for Virology was a mistake made in handling viruses where they're trying to do experiments on them to in some cases possibly for use as germ warfare, and also the market near there where there was a sale of a lot of wild animals under unhygienic conditions that could have led to animal to human transmission. And I mean, throughout the whole thing, they cleaned up the market early on. They removed all the animals, so we can't verify that. And we can't get proper access to the lab. Chinese scientists who might be helpful in the investigation are refused permission to speak or leave the country to appear at international conferences. And Western scientists who might be able to go in there and do investigations, some of the strongest people, have been for no reason denied visas to enter China. And China basically lies to the World Health Organization. So the whole thing is just appalling because, you know, health shouldn't be political. It should be something that the international community works on together for the common good of humanity, because viruses, as we know, don't respect political borders or political systems.
Was this failing to report a mistake or trying to hide something they were doing?
I mean, the fact that they you know, have been so uncooperative in every possible way and dissembling suggests that on the one hand, they're hiding some mistake, something, you know, maybe something about that market, maybe something about that lab. And then the second is also true, because we know that China did not come forward to the WHO with the person-to-person transmission of the virus until after they knew, and until after a lot of people flew out of Wuhan to other parts of China, and indeed even to Canada, because Chinese New Year corresponded with the period when it became apparent that we were dealing with a new and more virulent type of SARS.
Is there a liability issue here because of the harm that was ended up being inflicted on the world? Is there a liability? Could that be the reason?
Well, certainly there are people, I mean, particularly in the right wing in the United States, who think that China should pay and should be compensating for what they did. I mean, I'm inclined to think that, you know, an error made in a lab, I mean, these things happen. And the fact that the market say, wasn't meeting international standards for management of wild animals and sale and so on is another thing. But, you know, my feeling is that we shouldn't be allocating blame, but we should get to the bottom of what caused it so that we won't get an even worse virus again under similar circumstances. And that is clearly not being done.
So obviously, as you said, unlike SARS, this was cleaned up lickety split and nothing to see here, nothing going on. But the fact that we have found no other source, that we have found no other version of this story, we have found no other killer, doesn't that point to either the lab or the wet food market as one of the two?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. There's no question that originated in Wuhan, whatever the Chinese say about, oh, it came on the frozen meat that was imported into China or something like that. I mean, there's no scientific basis for that. Complete nonsense. So it's either the lab or it's the market. And let's hope it's the lab, because that was due to, you know, someone dropping a test tube or, you know, the higher tech equivalent of the same. If it was the market, that's worrying, because, you know, we need to know about the relationship between the bats and what animals and the humans and how it's transmitted. Because the next virus could be one that's, you know, even more serious and causes even more mortality around the world. And it's just very important for scientists to keep on top of the situation. And clearly, the Chinese are not going to allow that to happen. Whether, you know, they have internally information on this, which they're using to protect China in future, is another question. But really, you know, there's no justification for withholding information about a global epidemic causing disease. I mean, like that, you know, regardless of what kind of government you are, there's at least a sort of human decency and responsibility for humanity that says that regardless of whether mistakes were made or there was carelessness or whatever, or there was political issues, we should be given the truth so that we can respond on it in the interests of preventing a future virus.
Charles, the fact that they could not come up with a quick, effective vaccine certainly is, and treat it the way those in other Western worlds did. What does that say about their ability as a superpower? I mean, because everybody says, this is the next thing, this is it, this is it. And yet they are clearly behind us when it comes to this sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is true that, you know, due to systemic factors in China, they just aren't as good at innovative high-level science as other nations. I mean, they just, you know, they can't produce those high-level computer chips that are made in Taiwan, which, you know, make our cell phones work so well in such micro conditions. I think the other aspect of it was that, you know, we were prepared to provide China with the mRNA vaccines to inoculate their people to prevent the spread of the disease. And China refused to accept the foreign vaccines and insisted on using their own vaccines, which had a much lower level of ability to fend off that disease. And there again, you know, politics prevailed and there was nationalistic pride, and they just didn't want to accept that they couldn't produce that kind of sophisticated technology that was so effective here in Canada and other countries. And so they weren't going to even allow their people to benefit from it, even if we were prepared to donate it to them for free.
And we've got no time left, but is this conversation over then, Charles? Will we ever find out?
I don't think we're ever going to find out until there's a change of regime in China and the archives are opened up. Hmm. And then maybe we'll have some satisfaction. But, you know, the sooner we find out and the sooner we can address it accordingly, the better for the fate of humanity against awful, terrible diseases that cause suffering and death to our vulnerable elders and people around the world.
Charles Burton, senior fellow with Synopsis, finding the origins of COVID-19. Will we ever? We should be able to. Charles, thanks for the time and insight. Be well.
You too, Scott. Good to speak with you.
We've been talking about the budget and the fallout of the budget, which, of course, the Prime Minister used 3 weeks to make sure we understood it quite clearly. And now that we've had it, I'm not sure how we feel about it. The polls aren't looking like they have moved much. And I think one of the reasons with all of this is the Bank of Canada coming out a while ago and saying, you know, if one of those things, if it's an emergency, break glass, that's what we have to do when it comes to the economy. Innovation, productivity, investment in the country is all down. I remember Bob Rae saying, you cannot pay for programs without prosperity. And it's fascinating that we just keep going farther and farther, farther into the same direction rather than working on building the country. Let's bring in Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, here now. Ian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well, thank you, Scott.
So is this new budget going to help business? It seems that he's taken the words middle class out, put the wealthy in, but boy, the middle class can't buy homes. Now the family cottage is getting taxed. Doctors are their businesses are being hit. How are you supposed to digest this?
Well, my take is that this budget is going to make it worse. And I mean by that, and as I keep saying when we talk, I do not belong to any political party. I don't donate money to any political party. I do not consult to any corporations, and I don't have any investments. Since nobody is telling me what to say, I get people writing me saying, who told you to say this? Answer, me. I read, and I read a lot, and I read data, and I read David Dodge, and I read the governor of the Bank of Canada, and most importantly, I look at the numbers, the data, the numbers, people. Our productivity is declining year after year after year. Our business investment in factories and companies is declining, not going up, going down. Our R&D, which produces innovation, which produces productivity or helps enhance productivity, is declining. It's going down. And the U.S., of course, is going up. We've got all the data on this showing the U.S. productivity going up. Yeah. Ours is going down. The gap between the two countries is getting bigger. What that means in plain English, so everybody understands what this means. They can say this isn't a, an academic debate. No, as the productivity gap widens, the gap between the Canadian dollar and the US dollar is going to widen because it reflects the underlying competitiveness of the economy. Once the Canadian dollar was up at 90 cents, then it came down into the 80s. Now it's down in the 70s. If this trend continues, the Canadian dollar is going to continue to decline. And it can go down into the 60s. It was there once before. So this budget, because it did not focus on growth, it did not focus on competitiveness. In fact, it introduced measures that are going to accelerate the decline. The increase in the capital gains tax is going to incentivize and motivate our people that invest in businesses to go to the States. Why? Because they'll be taxed at a lower rate. This is not rocket science. What always puzzles me, Scott, about my progressive friends, and believe me, I do have a lot because I'm in the university, and most people in the university are progressive. And they say, and you hear it from Jagmeet Singh and others, corporations are greedy and all they care about is making money. Okay, yeah. Let's pretend that's true. I don't believe that's exclusively true. It's one of their motivations. But let's, for the purpose of this conversation, assume it's true. Then they go around and jack up the capital gains tax, and they say, "Oh no, no, these rich people, they're okay with that. They like paying more taxes and becoming less affluent." They're contradicting what they claim about the corporate capitalist sector. You can't suck and blow and have it both ways. Yeah. If they are really that greedy, then you, as they you claim, my progressive friends, then you have to assume that when you do something like make the taxation higher in Canada than the U.S., that you're going to drive those quote greedy people, end quote, to the States where the taxes are lower. And that's what we're doing because it is less competitive, less attractive. We need more competition in Canada, not less. We need more foreign capital in Canada. And that's our fundamental problem in this country.
It seems that this prime minister has taken the once great left of center Liberal Party and just moved it right over to the extreme left. It feels more like an NDP budget. Will this push voters back to the right towards the center, do you think?
I think we're witnessing that before our eyes in real time for the last 12 months approximately. Mm-hmm. We're seeing people that would never have voted or supported the Conservatives before have moved over because I think what's happened, my interpretation, and it's purely on the economic issues, is that large numbers of Canadians, including especially young people, and I have them in my class every year, every section, they have given up on Mr. Trudeau because they've realized that his, in aggregate, they've made this judgment that his policies together, all of his different policies, are going to make the country decline economically. And so they're voting. It's not about personality or whether they like or dislike him. He's a very likable person. Yeah. I think that they're voting and saying in the polls, I mean, expressing their preference in the polls by they have concluded, voters, large numbers of voters have concluded that the policy direction of this government writ large, all of the policies that they're doing, the spend, subsidizing battery plants to the tune of $15 billion a hit, you know, the increase in the carbon tax, the increase in the capital gains tax, all of these things taken together that the voters have voted really clearly. And it's not one poll. People can't say, oh, well, that's just one poll. I mean, there has been poll after poll after poll, liberal pollsters, conservative pollsters, centrist pollsters, and they all show the same thing. The gap between the liberals and the conservatives have widened. In fact, after this budget, there were two polls out yesterday, one by Ipso Reid and the other, Bruce Anderson, who's his daughter works for Mr. Trudeau. And Bruce Anderson is a longtime distinguished pollster in Canada. And his polls are showing that the budget, people are more negative on this government as a consequence of this budget than they were before. So they're concluding that the economic policies writ large, the framework, are taking Canada in the wrong direction and are hurting our productivity, which means our standard of living is going to go down.
Dr. Ian Lee, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, the productivity crisis in Canada.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson.
On Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
We remember that the Prime Minister used the budget to, I guess, make several unveilings of the budget 3 weeks ahead of time over the 3 weeks leading up to the budget, and then the final revealing or cost of on April 16th, which was Budget Day. Still, you know, it's interesting. I think we spent more time talking about it before, and I don't remember ever spending this much time talking about a budget afterwards and whether this all worked or not. And new Léger polling reveals how Canadians feel about this budget, and the new poll suggests half of Canadians have a negative opinion of the budget. To talk more about all this, Andrew Enns, Vice President, Executive Vice President, Central Canada for Léger, and here now. Andrew, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing well, Scott. Good to be back on your program.
So we saw this rolled out over 3 weeks. It was a communications issue, people not understanding what's going on, what the government is trying to do. So we need to explain it more fully. Did this work for them? Many thought that it was an ingenious idea to do it this way. However, I'm not sure it worked in this case.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think at the time, this has been a government that over the past, I'd say, year and a half, it's had a challenge sort of driving a narrative that it wanted to speak to, and I think they successfully used some of the budget elements and had a good two and a half weeks on housing and rental stuff, where they were sort of doing a whole bunch of announcements and kind of setting the message for those days and had some conversation going. At the end of the day, when you ask people, pull it all together. Unfortunately, I don't think it at this stage of the game. I mean, obviously, we'll see down the road in terms of the actual polling numbers and on who people might vote for. But at an initial blush, the response to this budget, 49%, said it, they feel fairly negative about it. 25%, very negative. Probably not the result they were hoping for. And there you go.
Is it a case of the Canadian public not hearing or understanding the narrative, or just they don't like it? They don't like the policy.
I think this is what's happening, Scott, is that I think, you know, people did hear what's going on. I think there was some buildup. There was some buildup to the budget. There's obviously been reactions to certain elements of it in terms of whether it's the capital gains tax, the housing announcements. I think what you have going on here, though, is, and even our poll, there's elements of what the government said and presented in the budget that Canadians say, I think this is good. I actually do think that spending this kind of money in housing is good. I think spending money on defense, you know, over half, 50% say it's good. I think the problem is that this is now a government at this stage in its mandate that doesn't have a lot of benefit of the doubt being provided by Canadians. Mm-hmm. I think this is You know, Canadians are saying, yeah, it sounds good, but I'm not buying it from you guys because I want to see the hard proof that it's working, that it's actually going to happen. And so I think you've got, you know, Canadians saying, yeah, I like it, but I'm not sure I'm buying what you're selling kind of thing, right? Like it's just, there's no sort of trust that this is going to happen. I think with respect to the Canadian public at this stage of the game with this government and, you know, a lot of governments get to this point.
Yeah. The reality is what it is. Now the Liberals are looking for a 5% increase in the polling and a 5-point jump in the polling by June in order to decide if easy now, Andrew, before they decide whether this has been successful or not. I'm guessing by your reaction, it's going to be pretty difficult to hit 5 points by June.
You know, and I wasn't reacting in the sense of of that it's some impossibility. It is, but I think it's just it seemed sort of odd that they would set that as their goal, like sort of go out there and say that's going to be our goal. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what the magic of June is. I mean, maybe you're up 5 points in June, but if you're down 7 by October, then, you know, it's just an interesting situation. I think if I'm sitting back now looking at this, I'm going to say, okay, guys, I don't think we're going to get whatever we counted on getting on the budget, we're not going to get. So what else can we do here? Because if we legitimately want 5 points by June, I think they've got to go back into, you know, to coin old, you know, Mr. Dressup. They have to go back into the tickle trunk.
So in other words, change direction or new leadership of some sort.
Well, I mean, obviously, I think if and you know, it's interesting then when you think to yourself of why would you put something out like that for, you know, like a 5-point jump by June? Is there some sort of you know, ulterior motive now that you can sort of set, well, we didn't get there. So what do we do now? We have to do something dramatically different. And to your point, I think probably the big card to play would be a leadership card.
What did you think this budget, not that they're supposed to do this in either way, maybe not even be relevant, but do you think this budget unites Canadians or creates more division?
I don't think it's done much to unite Canadians. You know, certainly we see, you know, there were still prime ministers doubling down on other provinces in terms of their concerns around the carbon tax. You've got now, you know, initially we saw, you know, the capital gains as, you know, these very rich tech entrepreneurs that were selling startup companies for, you know, multi-millions of dollars of profit going untaxed. Well, suddenly now, I mean, I read something in the paper where the Canadian Medical Association is saying that this is actually going to really hurt our ability to attract and retain doctors.
Yeah.
Hold on. How did we get there?
Andrew Enns with us, Executive Vice President, Central Canada for Léger. Your reaction to how you feel about the budget. And that's pretty much it. Andrew, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
Thank you, Scott. We'll talk again soon, I hope.
You may have heard of this, that the province is planning on upping the speed limit on certain 400 series of highways across Ontario. They did this on some a while back, including between here and Niagara. And to talk more about all of this, Brian J. Patterson, President, Ontario Safety League, and here now. Brian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Oh, all's well, all's well. I managed to make it home without seeing too many people driving like Lugans, so I have some faith left in the road system.
It's like golf. You only have to do it once and have a reasonably positive experience to go back at it again, Brian.
Oh, so true, so true. Yeah, this is good legislation for Ontario for three reasons. One, they did the preliminary work before they decided to add anything to the list. And the people who did it were the scientists and engineers. So we know we can handle that capacity. People will say everywhere and anytime. And at the end of the day, they did the preliminary work. Some of the stuff around Hamilton also involved a 2-year study of collisions and issues related to those crashes. And now we've implemented it. We kept one safety piece that the Ontario Safety League took to the minister, and they simply said, yes, you cannot go 50 kilometers over the 110 and get a stunt driving ticket. You can go 40 kilometers over and get the same ticket with the same consequences, because that kind of reckless driving has Newton's law of physics involved, not a highway traffic code. So good job on the province. Continued analysis will let us know how the expansion could take place as well.
All right. What do you say, Brian, to those who address the Ontario Safety League and say, anytime you increase the speed limit, forget it, that you're going to have more accidents? It's just common sense.
At the end of the day, speed is often a factor. But what we found in the analysis, and this is why I sort of say kudos to MTO's engineers and scientists, it wasn't just the speed. More often than not, when you get up in those ranges, you've got collisions and crashes where speed has expanded the damage, expanded the risk, and expanded the death. But the core is often distraction, inability, or weather conditions as well. So, you know, we all live in this province. Would you come down off the mountain in a snowstorm and try to maintain 110? Nobody would, except for one or two Lugans who want to make the front page.
So we talk about the technology in cars and how just the equipment that we're working with today is different from when these limits were set.
Oh, I think we can applaud engineers for airbags and structural changes and warning devices, et cetera. But at the end of the day, it's the person behind the wheel that is making those last-minute decisions. And some of the decisions cannot simply be handled by AI. So they can post everything and tell you how fast you could go. But we need to have the person behind the wheel confirm that it is either safe or not safe. I came up the 400 in a snowstorm, and I was amazed at the number of truck drivers who decided to maintain the 105 cap, and they were just spraying crap all over every driver on the highway. So you have to be able to understand how to drive appropriately. And I think the first question I get at a summer barbecue, Scott, is how fast are you allowed to go so you don't get a ticket? And I always say, there's a number on the big white sign that'll tell you. So we're balancing risk. That's a new in the last 10 years with transportation in Ontario. We balance the risk of the public and all drivers. And so in municipal areas, we're slowing people down because the pedestrian, cyclist deaths are always impacted by speed. And on the highways, you're not going to see it in a congested area because it doesn't allow for everybody to react. But if you're on your way down to Niagara, wide open, well, enjoy your trip. But stay within the posted limit. And if you choose to go above that, know that you're taking a risk for both yourself, the people in your vehicle, and anyone else on the roadway.
What about picking the right lane? You know, I joke around this because it's a slogan on the show, keep right except a pass. There used to be signs that would say that. They seem to have disappeared. And we have people that are passing on the left and the right. And, you know, you can imagine the problems that creates. What about the old adage that, you know, if you want to do whatever, you just go to the right. And if you want to pass, you go to the left. I mean, it seems a lot of people are becoming frustrated trying to get around other people.
I think the frustration level has led to very bad driving practices.
Yeah.
I often hear people who want to mansplain to me how the Autobahn works. I know how it works because I drove on it. And a lot of the people that want it in Ontario wouldn't be able to pass the driving test required to get a license in Germany, let alone drive on the Autobahn, because anybody who has will tell you those rules are absolutely enforced.
Yeah.
So if you decide that any of the actions that we see, I always think the next step is cameras, where people will pull over to the on-ramp, then go up the on-ramp for 150, 300 meters, and then they'll get back into traffic, and they'll jump back over to the on-ramp.
Right.
And they think nobody notices. The people who get frustrated by that happening. And, you know, at the end of the day, 10 kilometers is not going to get you there significantly faster. And you're going to have to accept, again, the scientists, indisputable, that you're going to burn more gas. So if you don't want to burn the extra gas, stay to the right, stay within that range. And in, you know, bad weather, congested weather, slow down. I always say 20 kilometer discount if it's raining, aside from putting your headlights on and your full wiper systems up, we just have to be more aware. And the car is not going to do that by AI, I can tell you that.
We've only got about a minute left, Brian. Photo radar, cameras in intersections, this the future. At one time, it was no way, yank them out. Are we going back to this, especially photo radar?
We are going to deploy technology appropriately to make the road safer. So when people say, for example, trucks are rearing down the highway, I believe they're way over the limit, et cetera, et cetera. Let's gain that evidence. And that evidence, those tickets could be issued from having cameras on the overpasses as they go barreling through. The same with those points, choke points, and aggressive driving areas. Put the camera up and start issuing some of the tickets. That technology is good. It's fair. It's clean. It's tested. Don't be afraid of cameras doing the right thing, particularly in school zones, near retirement homes, and in construction zones.
Brian J. Patterson with us, president of the Ontario Safety League. Give him the thumbs up to the upping of the speed limit on certain 400 series of highways outside of built-up areas. Brian, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Be well, stay safe, and pay attention if you're driving right now.
Scott Radley coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, thanks for the time. I hope you're well.
Perfect. How are you?
Top drawer. Are you excited about the Leaf game tonight?
Well, you're the Bruins fan, right? Your family is all chock full of Bruins fans, isn't it?
No. The latter part is right. I am not. I am a hometown. I don't care where I'm living, and whether I'm living in Calgary or Ottawa or Toronto, wherever. Hamilton, if they had a team, I would be supporting the home team, and that would be Toronto. So my son and I support Toronto. My son and my wife support Boston. And my daughter and I are supporting Toronto.
All right. Well, that's good to hear. And I'm disappointed.
Not really, because it's ugly.
Well, you know what? It is ugly because, look, fans of these two teams, as well as a bunch of other ones, Bruins fans have had plenty of success. Boston fans in general have had too much success with the Patriots, the Celtics, the Red Sox, the Bruins.
That's what my wife says. They're a winning city.
Yeah, they have been spoiled. And really, at this point, I think they should just be quiet because they have nothing more that we possibly want to hear from them because they've been spoiled beyond all measure. Meanwhile, those around here who are Leaf fans, Bills fans, Ticat fans, Jays fans. It has been just one constant repeat cycle of being hoofed in the gonadia season after season, year after year. If you have humanity only, Scott, you are cheering for the Leafs simply to ease. It's like in Field of Dreams, ease their pain.
It's a social thing.
It's humanity. Cheer for the Leafs just to ease their pain. Bruins fans, no sympathy for Bruins fans for anything that happens.
It's good for our mental health coming out of a global pandemic. We need this.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what we need because, look, game two for the Leafs was great. Austin Matthews was magnificent. Yeah. But the Bruins are the Bruins, and the Leafs have not beat the Boston Bruins in a series.
I think it's more like, no, the Leafs are the Leafs.
Well, that anyway. I was going to get to that in a second.
You beat me. Oh, sorry.
But I mean, look, the Bruins, they do win, and they are a great team. And even when they lose key players, which they have over the last number of years, they somehow still find a way to be the Bruins. And so, you know, if you're a Leaf fan, as I say, game two was encouraging. And was, you know, something that you can hope that is a sign of things to come. But while Bruins fans may just sit back and crack a cold one and go, okay, it's a game tonight, Leaf fans are always chewing their fingernails down to the nub, because why wouldn't they? What other tradition and history do they have other than to say, oh man, it looked good, but something bad's about to come around the corner?
What about coaching? Is that the first to go if the Leafs don't make this? I know he's left and then come back. But, you know, and not everybody's as loudmouth and passionate as I am. I get that. But he doesn't seem to want to talk to anybody. And I'm not sure when it comes to leadership if that's what this team needs.
Are you talking Sheldon Keefe?
Yeah. Okay. I think this team needs a coach that's ready to go over the bench.
I think that if, and look, I don't want to sound like I have anything special on this one, Scott. I think a lot of people have said this. If the Leafs don't win this series, I don't think the coach is back, but I think there's a lot of guys that may not be back, and I think it'll go higher than him. I think Brendan Shanahan, the president of the team, is in trouble if they don't win this series again. And then you're talking about the coach, and then you're probably talking about it, you know, who knows how much of a house cleaning you're doing with players. And it, like, I think last year we said it would be the end of an era if they didn't win. And then they got through and didn't win the next series that maybe they should have. And they said, oh, let's bring it all back. They've brought it all back so many times. Who knows if they would truly clean house. But at a certain point, if they don't win, they've got to say it's not working. But, you know, as I say, last game was the most optimistic I think Leaf fans had to be for their team, because their goalie played great, which was a big question mark, because Austin Matthews played great and he's the best player on the ice, and because there's still a bunch of guys on the Leafs that haven't played all that well, and you still managed to find a way to beat Boston in Boston. So there is reason for hope, for sure.
There's moments of greatness. It's just you never know what team you're going to get.
You never know what team you're going to get. And the thing is, I believe that the Buffalo Bills, well, Buffalo in general, but the Buffalo Bills are a cosmic experiment to see how much a fan base can be tormented and tortured. But the Leafs are not all that far behind, because the second you let your guard down as a Leaf fan and go, okay, things are good now, you know it's coming. You know something's coming. If the Leafs ever got to the final, Scott, and I mean, I know that that's...
Can you imagine that?
Well, I can't, because I've never been alive for that. But if the Leafs ever got to the finals, I don't know that Leaf fans would ever enjoy any of it.
Yeah.
Because the expectation would always be that the tragedy is just around the corner. You might enjoy it if they ever somehow won, but your enjoyment would only be for the countdown, like of the last 10 seconds of the game.
Yeah.
Because up until then, you would be convinced that the asteroid was just about to crash into Earth and everything was about to go wrong. And you would have every reason to, because that's all you've ever known.
It's like a grim on a wedding day. You're always in shock, so you really can't enjoy it.
Well, when she shows up and the doors open at the back of the church and she's standing there like, whew, okay, all right, she actually showed up. I can't believe it, but she's here. It's kind of, you're right, it's kind of the same thing, that there's just no evidence in a Leaf fan's psyche to lean on to say something good could happen. It can, but there's nothing to base that on.
There's a great joke about consummating a marriage that, you know, we should use right here, but we can't. We'd be in trouble.
That'll all right. After hours, Scott.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's the podcast. All right. Around. Have a great show.
Thanks, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. This one from Sue. I find it interesting that politicians cried foul on the use of strong mayor's powers when introduced by Premier Ford, until, of course, they need them to push through their own agenda. Then it's different. Sue.
Keep right, accept to pass.